At Peasemarsh Station, we said goodbye, and he got out, and I saw him ride off. I went on to London, where I stayed the night. When I got home the next afternoon, a very wet one, by the way, my sister greeted me with, "Where's Mr. Charrington?" "Goodness knows," I answered testily. Every man since Cain has resented that kind of question. "I thought you might have heard from him," she went on, "as you're to give him away tomorrow." "Isn't he back?" I asked, for I had confidently expected to find him at home. "No, Geoffrey." My sister Fanny always had a way of jumping to conclusions, especially such conclusions as were least favorable to her fellow creatures. "He has not returned, and what is more, you may depend upon it, he won't. You mark my words, there'll be no wedding tomorrow." My sister Fanny has a power of annoying me which no other human being possesses. "You mark my words," I retorted with asperity. "You had better give up making such a thundering idiot of yourself. There'll be more wedding tomorrow than ever you'll take the first part in." A prophecy which, by the way, came true. But though I could snarl confidently to my sister, I did not feel so comfortable when late that night I, standing on the doorstep of John's house, heard that he had not returned. I went home gloomily through the rain. Next morning brought a brilliant blue sky, gold sun, and all such softness of air and beauty of cloud as go to make up a perfect day. I woke with a vague feeling of having gone to bed anxious, and of being rather averse to facing that anxiety in the light of full wakefulness. But with my shaving water came a note from John, which relieved my mind and sent me up to the Forsters with a light heart. May was in the garden. I saw her blue gown through the hollyhocks as the lodge gates swung to behind me. So I did not go up to the house, but turned aside down the turfed path. "He's written to you, too," she said, without preliminary greeting, when I reached her side. "Yes, I'm to meet him at the station at 3 and come straight on to the church." Her face looked pale, but there was a brightness in her eyes and a tender quiver about the mouth that spoke of renewed happiness. "Mr. Branbridge begged him so to stay another night that he had not the heart to refuse," she went on. "He is so kind. But I wish he hadn't stayed." I was at the station at 2:30. I felt rather annoyed with John. It seemed a sort of slight to the beautiful girl who loved him that he should come, as it were, out of breath, and with the dust of travel upon him, to take her hand, which some of us would have given the best years of our lives to take. But when the 3 o'clock train glided in and glided out again, having brought no passengers to our little station, I was more than annoyed. There was no other train for 35 minutes. I calculated, with much hurry, we might just get to the church in time for the ceremony. But, oh, what a fool to miss that first train! What other man could have done it? That 35 minutes seemed a year, as I wandered round the station reading the advertisements and the timetables and the company's bylaws, and getting more and more angry with John Charrington. This confidence in his own power of getting everything he wanted the minute he wanted it was leading him too far. I hate waiting. Well, everyone does. But I believe I hate it more than anyone else. The 3:35 was late, of course. "Drive to the church," I said as someone shut the door. "Mr. Charrington hasn't come by this train." I ground my pipe between my teeth and stamped with impatience as I watched the signals. Click! The signal went down. 5 minutes later, I flung myself into the carriage that I had brought for John. Anxiety now replaced anger. What had become of the man? Could he have been taken suddenly ill? I had never known him to have a day's illness in his life, and even so, he might have telegraphed. Some awful accident must have happened to him. The thought that he had played her false never, no, not for a moment, entered my head. Yes, something terrible had happened to him, and on me lay the task of telling his bride. I almost wish the carriage would upset and break my head so that someone else might tell her, not I, who... But that's nothing to do with this story. It was 4:05 as we drew up at the churchyard gate. A double row of eager onlookers lined the path from lych gate to porch. I sprang from the carriage and passed up between them. Our gardener had a good front place near the door. I stopped. "Are they waiting still, Byles?" I asked, simply to gain time, for of course I knew they were by the waiting crowd's attentive attitude.
"Waiting, sir? No, no, sir. Why, it must be over by now."
"Over? Then Mr. Charrington's come?"
"To the minute, sir. Must have missed you somehow.
And I say, sir," lowering his voice, "I never see Mr. John the least bit so afore. But my opinion is he's been drinking pretty free. His clothes was all dusty, and his face like a sheet. I tell you, I didn't like the looks of him at all. And the folks inside are saying all sorts of things. You'll see. Something's gone very wrong with Mr. John, and he's tried liquor. He looked like a ghost, and in he went with his eyes straight before him, with ne'er a look or a word for none of us. Him that was always such a gentleman."
I had never heard Byles make so long a speech. The crowd in the churchyard were talking in whispers, and getting ready rice and slippers to throw at the bride and bridegroom. The ringers were ready with their hands on the ropes to ring out the merry peal as the bride and bridegroom should come out. A murmur from the church announced them. Out they came.
Byles was right. John Charrington did not look himself. There was dust on his coat. His hair was disarranged. He seemed to have been in some row, for there was a black mark above his eyebrow. He was deathly pale. But his pallor was not greater than that of the bride, who might have been carved in ivory, dress, veil, orange blossoms, face and all. As they passed out, the ringers stooped. There were six of them. And then, on the ears expecting the gay wedding peal, came the slow tolling of the passing bell. A thrill of horror at so foolish a jest from the ringers passed through us all. But the ringers themselves dropped the ropes and fled like rabbits out into the sunlight. The bride shuddered, and gray shadows came about her mouth. But the bridegroom led her down the path where the people stood with the handfuls of rice, but the handfuls were never thrown, and the wedding bells never rang. In vain the ringers were urged to remedy their mistake. They protested with many whispered expletives that they would see themselves further first. In a hush, like the hush in the chamber of death, the bridal pair passed into their carriage, and its door slammed behind them. Then the tongues were loosed, a babble of anger, wonder, conjecture from the guests and the spectators.
"If I'd seen his condition, sir," said old Forster to me as we drove off, "I would have stretched him on the floor of the church, sir, by heaven I would, before I'd let him marry my daughter."
Then he put his head out of the window.
"Drive like hell," he cried to the coachman. "Don't spare the horses."
He was obeyed. We passed the bride's carriage. I forbore to look at it, and old Forster turned his head away and swore. We reached home before it. We stood in the doorway in the blazing afternoon sun, and in about half a minute we heard wheels crunching the gravel. When the carriage stopped in front of the steps, old Forster and I ran down.
"Great heaven! The carriage is empty! And yet..."
I had the door open in a minute, and this is what I saw. No sign of John Charrington. And of May, his wife, only a huddled heap of white satin lying half on the floor of the carriage and half on the seat. "I drove straight here, sir," said the coachman as the bride's father lifted her out, "and I'll swear no one got out of the carriage." We carried her into the house in her bridal dress and drew back her veil. I saw her face. Shall I ever forget it? White. white and drawn with agony and horror, bearing such a look of terror as I have never seen since, except in dreams. And her hair, her radiant blonde hair, I tell you, it was white like snow. As we stood, her father and I, half mad with the horror and mystery of it, a boy came up the avenue, a telegraph boy. They brought the orange envelope to me. I tore it open. Mr. Charrington was thrown from the dogcart on his way to the station at 1:30. Killed on the spot. And he was married to May Forster in our parish church at 3:30, in presence of half the parish. I shall be married, dead or alive. What had passed in that carriage on the homeward drive, no one knows. No one will ever know. Oh, May, oh, my dear. Before a week was over, they laid her beside her husband in our little churchyard on the thyme-covered hill, the churchyard where they had kept their love trysts. Thus was accomplished John Charrington's wedding.